course, I trespassed over to Auntie's by breaching the restricted trail and traipsing through the protected forest. I planned on ringing her doorbell for help. I wished she wouldn't turn me away, ignore me, her once-loved niece. The idea of even having to ring her doorbell bristled my nerves as I crossed over her dirt driveway. Up until 2 years ago, I used to practically live part-time at Auntie's. I think about that moment now, in this hole, the bristling feeling of being a stranger in a place that was once a home. I reverted to being a child, and as I did, one memory stood out, as one chock full of evidence of the nascent, or chronic, or manic, I do not know, turmoil in Auntie. In real time and to a child's mind, the day was bright and happy. It is in retrospect only, as an adult, and now lying in a hole, I rethink this memory. I was 13. I was spending the weekend at Auntie's same pink Haddock Point house. Manny was over playing with me. We'd just dug 2 potatoes from Auntie's kitchen garden, the one below her kitchen's bay window with the yellow and green curtains and the flower box stuffed with hot pink wave petunias. Blue morning glories crawled up lattice on each side like 20-foot exterior drapes, framing all her colonial's first and second floor warbled glass windows and scraping high to meet the newer windows on the dormers in her refurbished attic. Manny stayed outside, crafting a round target out of vines so we could play a game of rubber-tipped arrow archery. I held the dirty potatoes, one in each dirty hand. My feet were bare and dirty, too. And since the grass I'd sloshed through was wet with dew, my muddy footprints marked a path through Auntie's marble foyer, onto her turquoise bubble-print runner, and slip-sliding to the honeywood floors of the front hall and living room. My pippy braids were coming loose, and several twigs pinned my hair. Before the potatoes, Manny and I had chased one of the ubiquitous wild bunnies into a butterfly bush, because I suspected him and a line of possible culprits of stealing Auntie's bloomed roses. Manny's theory was more romantic than mine. He guessed that a seagull named Frank was one by one picking off the rose petals with his beak so he could build a giant rose on the cliff wall each night, trying to attract the love of a mermaid named Vanessa. Manny was like that, dreamy. Is he still like that? Is he still alive? Back on the day when we were 13 and I entered Auntie's house with my muddy feet and the muddy potatoes, Auntie stared out a living room window with sheer white curtains, tied in the middle with a dried starfish affixed to bendable wire. All around her, squadrons of sea turtles, rainbows of fish, and varieties of mermaids swang among raspberry coral in the colorful patterned wallpaper. She plucked double pendants in the divot of her neck as she twisted from the window to see me and my cyclone of soil in the hall. She always wore those double pendants, gold baby shoes for the babies she lost before they grew full term. I offered the dirty potatoes with outstretched palms. She fisted one in each hand and stared at them. Then she puckered her lips and braced one arm across her belly. Raising the dirt of one potato to graze her face and soil her shiny hair, she lifted a hand and pointed out the window. Silt rained around her and onto her starched apple-green dress. And as I look back on the memory, here in this hole of lunacy, her actions and words were untethered, I believe, disconnected from the reality of what she was doing. Disconnected. Right now, I pop my resting eyes open in reliving this childhood memory, and I stare, like Auntie stared out her window that day. I stare at a dirt wall 1 inch from my nose. Smells musty and thick in this hell. Perhaps I'm disconnected too. shimmy my shoulders again into my companion and procure a weaker breath in response, but a breath nonetheless. So I close my eyes. And I'm back. I'm back to my memory of 12 years ago when I was 13. "This bird," Auntie said, breaking out of her silence and thumbing backward toward her favorite willow. "This red cardinal in my tree where Manny's hanging the vine target. He's very funny," she said in all seriousness. "He's..." She shook her head. "All morning he's been chirping jokes while you two played. But the twigs in the tree are too ignorant to get the punchlines, and the leaves are too snobby to laugh. I think the cardinal needs to work on his timing." She shook her head again, then appraised me and my outdoor self indoors. "I'm sorry, Auntie. I made a mess." "What mess?" She squirreled her eyes at me like I was hallucinating. "Go talk to that funny bird. Give him some tips, funny girl." I don't know why she called me funny girl. She was the funny one. I was just her audience, the one who would laugh because she was funny, and I loved her. Now, as I think back on it, survey our shared history while I await death, this lightness of her making twigs and leaves sentient is confusing. Auntie was always otherwise so clinical and realistic. Funny, usually, yes, but a hard-boiled humor. And yet, there were these light times when she entertained a more mystical outlook on life, which I wonder now, for isn't it clear after what we've gone through? Was this twig-leaf moment one of high mania? Back then, I was just happy she was happy. As I walked out, leaving her with the potatoes, she kept talking to the window, not to me. "They should laugh, the twigs and the leaves. They should laugh at the bird's jokes. He's trying so hard for them, working really hard, chit-chit-chitting on and on in his routine. But nothing. Once he figures on them, he'll use the dumb twigs for a nest and he'll leave droppings on the uppity leaves." She turned to see me in the hall where I'd stalled and listened. Again she stared in total blankness. Then she laughed her big, bull, echoey auntie laugh that always made me laugh, too. Like one sneeze leads to another's sneeze. I was a little muddy girl with messy braids, giggling with her shiny auntie in a sunny living room. After, she sliced those potatoes into shoestrings and fried them up for an impromptu mid-morning snack for me and Manny. The same day as the funny bird incident, after Manny was called home by his father, Auntie and I spent the day nailing together a birdhouse. I painted it the same pink that adorned her home, and then decorated around drawn-on windows with painted blue morning glories, all to make a perfect matching home for that funny, funny bird. "I love that we have Manny here for you to play with," Auntie said while we worked. "Keeps you close to me, funny girl. At my house, not that stuffy Rye estate, right? We have so much fun here," she said, with a twitching nose and kitty-cat smile. I recall feeling an odd conflict when she said this, perhaps the way she said it. As an adult now, I think I can better interpret what I then felt as a child. Perhaps a guarded possession is one thing I felt, for I had chosen Manny. Manny was my friend, someone separate from everyone else in our tight family. In retrospect, as I shiver in this hot hole 12 years after she said it, as I probably die of fever and shock and blood loss and terrifying fear that my companion will die a worse death than me, I don't think I liked Auntie's use of the word "we" in the context of having Manny. But I think I also felt ashamed for thinking Auntie was claiming, stealing something of mine, a piece of my separate love, because that would allow an imperfection in her perfect shine. How I'd grown to define her, a definition that gave me great comfort and freedom. I recall my physical wince. I recall shaking my head to shake out, in a tangible way, the brewing conflict. I recall beating the flash of darkness away by nailing into the birdhouse a little harder, a few pounds. And all was well again. Blocking out darkness is a family trait, a family strength I've come to hone. Auntie designed a trap door on the bottom of the birdhouse, within which to hide a second set of her ring of house keys. Everything she has ever built, as far as I know, includes fake doors or rooms or hidden compartments. She always used to say they were part of her security system, what with not having a man living on premises in any permanent way. Even when pregnant with her longtime boyfriend's babies, she still didn't allow him to move in, and she certainly didn't allow him to move in after both miscarriages. He's long gone now. Been gone forever. But her multiple screen doors and hidden keys remain. So we built that funny bird a birdhouse with a trap door for her duplicate ring of house keys. Auntie showed me how to use her circular saw and drill. Auntie handed me her hammers and nails. Auntie never hired a live-on premises caretaker like we have in Stuffy Rye. I loved that at her house we had no servants or others hovering over us. We buttered our own toast. She, not a governess, not a maid, would bring cups of water to my room at night. She was free to do as she please, she said. Free as the wind. What does it mean to be free as the wind? I wish a wind would swoop into this hell and cool and wake us, make us both alive and alert. I pop open my eyes again. The dirt wall is still there. The musty stench, the wetness of humidity, my sweat, my companion's sweat. I sit up, cross my legs. Still sitting in my companion's crescent space, I place my hands on the dirt wall and drop my head. Breathe in through my nostrils, slow, controlled, so as to stem a rising nausea and to gather what strength I can. Our time is coming to act, to do something. As I contemplate and calm my body, I fast forward from age 13 to 2 weeks ago, when all our current traumas coalesced into leading us here to this hole. 2 weeks ago, I clutched my crazy, loving childhood impression of Auntie as I trudged through Haddock's Point Side Trail, the protected forest, and trespassed onto her summer lawn, which had been so familiar to me growing up. I assumed the place would be in disrepair, or some other visible sign of neglect would match the neglect she'd thrown us, her family, for 2 solid years. So it angered me when I stumbled upon her green-cut lawn with no weeds and her perennial beds bursting in rainbows, accenting her still pink house. And when I saw those window boxes stuffed with hot pink petunias, and the crawling blue morning glories on the backside, so too the pink birdhouse I made with her and for her funny bird and house keys, I felt a ringing betrayal. If life went on for her, unharmed and still fresh, why did she refuse us a place in her life? For me, her once-loved niece. And when I caught her humming a happy tune and leaving her natural wood barn, one big enough for horses and tractors and a high loft, the place in which she taught me to use her hammer and nails, her drill and circular saw, the tune angered me further. For how could she be happy alone out here without us? My mind could not understand her humming to herself, so naturally high, when my mother, her sister, remained swallowed by the ocean. Right there. Right through the brambles, across the rocky boundary, an eighth of a mile hike is all to the sea, her grave. My mother's hair strands snagged in the nasty vines, which were proven singed by her burning dress along the path. Her burned dress and one of her shoes washed up on the cliff wall where they say she jumped. Her footprints. Everything. All the forensics. What had I done to Auntie to deserve her abandonment for 2 years after that awful night? When I stood in her driveway, stunned at the apparent perfection of Auntie's property, having expected to find only disrepair, she turned around and saw me. Her humming stopped, and so did the mirage of perfection. In a snap, Auntie's world was no longer a cartoonish summer of Disney birds and heavenly flowers. No. It all changed to horror. Like a torch lit the technicolor film of reality and the whole reel melted. 20 yards away, her face was as clear as 1 foot from mine in the waning summer light. Her punctured eye, punctured 2 years ago on that night, remained dead and glazed in a milky film, and indeed, unpatched, brazen and naked to the day. The scar she acquired that night, rivered from above and through her dead eye, straight down like a bloated and malformed earthworm. She clearly hadn't had it subdued by a plastic surgeon, as I'd expected. Standing, staring at me like a zombie, her mouth slack, she revealed her broken maw. Several smashed, missing, jagged teeth. So she also had not seen a dentist. And her hair was no longer a shiny chestnut, but wiry gray, flying in the sea wind. Like she for real transformed into one of those fictional, cranky, hunchback witches we used to dream up for stories when I was a child. Auntie's only in her 40s. But she appeared to be a neglected, perhaps depraved woman in her late 80s. Why no eye patch? No doctor? No dentist? No personal maintenance, but attentive care to her grounds? And her humming as she exited her barn. Was it a song of happiness or lunacy? Now, 2 weeks later, looking back to that moment, these mysteries are mere superficialities, what with the profound shocks to come. I could not contain my jaw from flapping open, in awe of the transformed woman I loved and missed an eternity. Oh, how I needed love, and still do. The space in my chest where my heart should be felt like a sucking, swirling black hole. Before saying hello, she held up a timid index finger to shush me, turned and took quick care to loop a chain several times through the barn's sliding pocket door and lock the links with 3 separate bike locks. Then she said, "Hi." "What's in the barn?" She's never locked the barn before, locking from the outside to keep what within? To keep what? Who? Out. Her property is secluded, no homes around. Why the shushing finger? We're alone. What's in the barn? What the fuck is in the barn? Perhaps when I got here 2 weeks ago, I should have followed my instincts and fled when Auntie locked her barn and looked at me with her crazed, broken face. In that moment, I should have walked. But shock, the worst of mental thieves, forced me to slip back into the well of my mind fog. Auntie turned, shushed me, face naked with bloated earthworm scar across her dead eye, locked her barn 20 yards from me, and stared me down with her one remaining eye. She tried to smile, which made her appear deranged or wicked or both, what with her villain's face full of busted teeth. A passing sea wind picked the dry strands of her hair, grade 65%, and lifted them like electrical frying.
What? You turned us away for 2 years, and now you... What do you have in the barn?
My car broke down. I need your help, I shouted, still standing by her pink home's blue front door.
Why did she lock the barn? Why is she shushing me? No one is around. No neighboring homes. What the hell is in the barn? And what did she say? Did she answer my questions?
No. She flipped me an evil smile, like someone who she is not, like someone insane, and said,
Get in the house, funny girl.
In the flat affect of the criminally depraved. Or perhaps like someone trying to keep a lid on something about to boil over and that would burn us whole. I couldn't tell which persona she was, villain or protector. In that moment, with her confusing directive to get in the house, funny girl, I think I too turned insane, desperate to find traction and climb out of my well of fog and denial and grief, but slipping. I focused on the barn. The barn is huge. Natural wood siding and two giant doors that, when opened, allow you to drive a tractor on in and out. I remembered the back door to her barn, the hidden one behind which Manny and I would wait to make grand entrances for our theatrical performances, on a stage made of shipping crates, with stage curtains made of old sailboat sails. I ran around the back, past the herb garden, catching a ground cloud whiff of rosemary, beyond the side of the barn, burst to the hidden back entrance, which you have to know exists to find, and found it barred from the outside with a crosshatch of boards, which had never been there before.
Why the barring from the outside? Why bar the possibility of leaving the barn?
But I was outside, so I removed the boards and threw them on the ground. After clearing the door and entering, I slithered to the center of the barn, which looked the same as always, a mottled lit middle where one might park two tractors, and on each side, two horse stalls, all four of which Auntie had converted to hold the stuff of four different hobbies. In the houseworks construction stall, there remained her circular saw, the hammers, the nails, all her tools laid in perfect placement on a workbench, and a hatchet on a hook. The smell was of dry dirt. Everything in the inner part of the barn was the same, too. Manny's and my shipping crate stage with the sailing sails curtains weighted in a corner, prop box taking center stage, the lid on. I looked around in a frantic way until I saw lights on in a temperature-controlled side addition to the barn. A place Auntie used to say she'd built to use as an all-season potting shed, but actually used to store all her nursing stuff. In I entered, discovering the side room upgraded with functioning medical gear, flashing monitors, a stand with a saline drip, a metal medical bed, and in that bed, connected to the monitors and the drip, a woman, out cold, eyes shut, oblivious to me in the doorway. All this 2 weeks ago, the start of our descent into total unhinged madness. Or maybe we've been in this dark sink of madness for 2 years anyway, ever since that damn fire. Right now, in present time, a woman with a hatchet has found our hiding spot. She just crashed in on our hole, and I hear her roaming around up top now, circling the wooden cover with her heavy stomping.
You bitch! I'll end this now!
She must jump with both feet on top of the wooden cover above our heads. Dirt and paint chips cascade and snow our hair.
The storm is picking up mad winds, howling, slicing winds above. I hear the wild sea out beyond, and I'm sure the sky is about to release a biblical flood. I want the strength to haul on out of here, push on past her, break into Auntie's house, crack open her glass gun case, and grab her Roosevelt gun. I want to see if Manny's alive, but I'm frozen. The woman up top stamps her feet on the wooden cover above. More paint chips and soot rain down in our hair. I can't tell if the whispers for mop, mop, mop are from the wind, the ocean waves crashing beyond, my imagination coiled in my fear, or real from my companion.
Chapter 4. Auntie Liv. 2 years ago, Auntie's property, the guest cottage.
You know what you should do?
My sister Johanna says. She's sprawled on the queen-size iron bed I put in her guest cottage behind my barn. The open window catches the sound of the crashing Atlantic past the acres of corkscrew trees, brambles, and vines. The salty sea air washes in with each seismic wave. Johanna's atop a pink and green quilt I purchased at the local artisan fair in Rockport. I just told her about my affair with Chief Surgeon Kent Drainel, and I'm leading up to another truth I must reveal, and also today's allergic murder I witnessed by hearing. Allergic murder I witnessed? What has happened? Get a grip. Focus. Say the words. Tell her. I keep trying to interrupt my little sis, rushing through facts and telling her I'm upset and traumatized. But the problem is, I can't get her to focus, and I can't focus either. I feel untethered, unable to grasp a lasting thought, like my brain is drugged and my mind disembodied. Like the night when I was 14 and Johanna was out with Mother shopping, safe, and I was left home, dragged to the brick coach house by the estate manager, and he shoved a metal pin he used to affix to his shirt. The color blue it was, with the shape of California as the image, in my mouth. And my father came in, and, like the two nights I miscarried, like when I lost hold of all reason when I found out why Johanna's sister-in-law, Sister Mary, really left the church. I should have been stronger all those times. I should be stronger now. But has each event left me weak? Am I? Weak? Is that why Kent keeps me, like Kate said? No, stop. Don't think of the past. Don't think of weakness. Think of today. Tell Johanna you need help. Get help. Don't turn in on yourself this time. Don't. When I got home in a fluster tonight, I found Johanna drunk on Bordeaux. Of course, she cracked the entire case during the day while I was working, spying and then working in Boston. The turquoise polka dot bedside lamp is tipped to the side from her flailing arm, which she's still thrusting in fruitless attempts to flick ash ends off her Marlboro into the oyster shell ashtray. The oyster shell is mouth down to the wood floor, ashes everywhere. I pick it up and move it along with her moving hand like a net holder under a man about to jump from a building. As soon as she smashes the butt in the shell, I reset the shell to its decorative place on the white wicker nightstand. It's not supposed to be an ashtray. The nightstand should be holding a clean shell, the turquoise polka dot lamp upright, and a sweet summer romance for bedtime reading. Instead, this cottage is a soiled dorm room for a drunk girl. Johanna, unstoppable, lights another cigarette. I correct the lamp. Son of a bitch. My sister, Johanna, Jojo Beans, Sis, Joe. She's not an alcoholic, but she's a damn goldfish whenever I get a shipment of this Bordeaux in from France. It's a specific vintage she and Mop and I found a few years ago when we rented a cottage in Saint-Rémy-de-Provence. Mop was only 16, but quand on France. So we lent her 2 sips, one from Jojo's goblet, one from mine. Mop drank her minor first sips in a solemn silence and declared the event a sacramental taste of family blood. Then she twisted her lips like she does in a shrug and added, and Joanna and I froze our goblets midair, awaiting Mop's expected dismissive tagline, "Well, not really. It's just wine." Joe and I clinked a cheer once Mop delivered her predictable line, and then rolled eyes at the girl who turns everything into some profound religious occurrence, only to flip to ambivalence, like she's juggling an internal debate between dramatic faith and sterile reality. What I would do for a stitch of Mop's depth, her introspection, her willingness to seek traction into things unknown, only to deny them. The girl is a complicated ball of contradictions, but she is colorful in her personal cyclone, and thus alive. I'm jaded, losing my colors. I don't pose questions about anything anymore. Doing so would require me to consider events of my past, and whenever I do, I fail in a scary, psychological way. So, I must remain clinical. Even today, even after what I witnessed, I went to St. Jerome's an hour after leaving Proserpina's. By then, they'd already cleared Vicky for removal to the morgue. I played dumb and jaded and callous, just another dead woman, who cares? What happened today? How? Is hearing witnessing if you do not see with your eyes? My God, Kate murdered her neighbor, someone named Vicky. I want my peaceful life back. I have grown insane, lost my grip, the world around me also insane. The lamp, Johanna! Damn it! Johanna Vandenbeer Pentecost, stop! Listen! My God, you with the cigarettes. You don't even smoke, I say, riding the polka dot lamp again on the wicker nightstand. Her white cotton nightgown reminds me of when we were girls, but her braless boobs, tanned to a summer pumpkin, sweat through and remind me she's very much a grown woman. And here she's going to give me grown woman drunk advice on what to do about my extramarital affair, and she doesn't know the whole truth or the real horror yet. My heart's about to bust through my ribcage. Oh, Livy, don't call me by my first name. You're not Mumsy Mum. She giggles, then grows drunk serious, so with a fighting devil smile. I smokes when I drinks, Liv, and no, she stutters, blubbering her lips, her eyelids dragging to stay open, the right one drooping more than the left. You listen to meesy me, Sister Pister. You know what you should do? You should write a big mean letter to this wife. Be super duper mean as you can. Get it all out. And then you rip it up. You, you never send. Rip it up to the up. She makes like she's ripping her pale pink cotton top sheet like paper, which is impossible, because of course I got her precious wax ass, the 1 billion thread count from Frette. Bad paper, she smacks at the sheet for not ripping like paper. She doesn't notice facts. All she sees is the last drop of Bordeaux I'll allow her tonight. She's done. I know the signs. Go to sleep, Jojo. We'll talk in the morning. I tuck her in like I always do, or she always does for me. As I kiss her hairline, I take and extinguish her lit cigarette and gather the remaining pack. I skid across the high shine of the pine floor and place the half pack in the jewelry drawer, which sits like a cherry on a cake, top center on the coral dresser. I gather the spent bottles of Bordeaux. Somehow she drained 2 on her own today. I'll hide the rest of the case so I can at least have a half glass. Perhaps save a sip or 2 for myself. She'll drink, I'll sip, tomorrow night. I work the evening shift tomorrow, so I'll bury the bottles in my house good and deep, behind the false bookcase to the secret wine room. Johanna doesn't have a formal job to worry about, but she is supposed to be orchestrating the Mighty Mary Charitable Trust Gala our family hosts every year at the Saleo Country Club. Shit, that's in 3 days. It feels so far off, and it seems, how odd, I won't make it to my own event. Feels like insurmountable mountains of stress and horror and reality lie between me and the event. I hope Johanna has the arrangements settled, the caterer squared off like she always does. If all Johanna has scheduled tomorrow is a liquid lunch with the valet captain to ensure the Rolls Royces are parked just so, she still needs to make decisions and be somewhat functional. So, I'm shutting her down for the night. Mop isn't back from Princeton for another few days, so I have this time to unravel for Johanna. Time for Johanna to patch me back up. I trip on her absurd animal print Tory birch flats on the way out of her single-shake cottage, so I scoot them under the sand dollar couch. Sand dollars embroidered in blue against the couch's ivory. Johanna and I have the same size feet, but we definitely do not share shoes. I'm a nurse and often in white naturalizers. She's a glamour girl in prints and colors and couture. At charity galas, I wear classic black spikes. She's in items designers make once and only for her. So it will say so under her picture's caption on the society page of North Shore magazine. The animal print Tory Burch I scoot under the couch must snag popover. From under the nether regions of the third cushion comes an angry meow from the gray short hair with lime eyes who travels everywhere with Johanna. Everyone's pissing me off today, so I pull slam the door in response to popover. Damn cat. Damn everyone. How do I make sense of this day? I'm a nurse. I've seen death many times. I'm numb to it, immune. But I am not numb to murder. I am not numb to madness. I don't know how to clear this fog I'm in. He hasn't called me. I'm too afraid to ring him. Won't email him. Actually, neither of us use email anyway. Our lives are medical, and the height of our technology is inputting patient stats into electronic records. I carry a beeper and a flip phone. Mop is always busting my ass about this. And I don't text. No such capability. I use the internet to check the tide schedule and weather. Maybe copy some recipes. No Facebook, no Twitter, no Instagram. I garden and paint and sometimes land a supporting role in the Gloucester Theater in my free time. So there is no electronic trail of our affair for her to find, at least as far as I know. The kiss-top room we use, he expenses to the hospital, which is another story. And still, I have a growing fear she's figured us out. Oh, I should never have whispered in her ear at Proserpina's. I'm 43, I know better. His name is Dr. Kent Drainel. Her name is Kate Drainel, the Drainels. A terrible last name. If I were ever to marry him, which, as I clear an inch of my mind fog, I realize I never will, I'd keep Vanden Beer as my last name. Drainel, Banel, Anal. I can hear the schoolhouse taunts. What was I thinking, falling for a man with a name like that? Huge mistake, saying his name to Johanna, because speaking it led to her laughing fit and a 3-second swallow straight from the mouth of the Bordeaux. She sang, Drainel is an anal, banal, anal, anal, ass. If only she knew. And now she's passed out in the guest cottage, and I'm alone with my thoughts, walking along the flower path in the backyard to my rose house. The solar lights in the perennial beds, the twinkle lights in the trees illuminate my way. I pass my barn to the side, snaking a finger on the clapboards of the small room addition. I peek in the window and notice the overhead on in the side room, which was supposed to be an all-year potting shed, but isn't any longer. No light should be on. I hear a footstep within. I shake. Maybe just the wind, or one of those coyotes. Maybe Johanna worked in there today and left the light on. I've lived on this property my adult life by myself, no full-time man protecting me. I can handle security. I must handle security. I can't be the cause again of someone's death.
Oh, Daddy, I'm sorry. I miss you.
Stop. What's that? That's definitely a footstep in the barn. A sliver of a shiver crackles up my spine, and I freeze on the spot. An ocean wind of wet, salt air, humid and sticky, swipes my cheeks in passing. I paste my body against the barn's siding and walk on tender feet to the back of the barn. My weed whacker leans beside the secret back entrance, which appears like the rest of the backside and not like a doorway at all. I grab the weed whacker and hold it like a fighting lance as I enter the barn. Stalling once inside, I plant my feet and bend my knees like I'm some warrior, as if a 40-something woman holding the right posture is surefire self-defense. The T-length poly-blend skirt and inner slip of my nursing uniform restrict the width of my crouch. I see no moving shadows. I hear no shifting feet. I freeze within, wait for some breath from some corner, but nothing. The light in the barn's side saddle of a room crackles and dims and brightens in a soft amber with every blow of New England wind. I decide it's safe to move on to the light that should not be on. Still holding my weed whacker like a lance, I'm halfway through the middle of the barn, which used to house horses. Under the high roof, you could park 2 tractors in the center and 4 horses in side stalls if you wanted. I converted the stalls to different crafting and construction purposes. 1 stall with my construction tools, saw, hammer, hatchet, etc. 1 for making sea glass sculptures for Johanna. 1 for potting and gardening. And 1 for the stuff of painting ocean landscapes. Easel, brushes, oils, acrylics. There's a pin light on in the sea glass stall, a tiny desk lamp Johanna keeps there. From the outside, I hadn't appreciated this light was on, too. In moving to the sea glass stall, I swear another footfall creeps behind me, but when I turn, I note the noise is the bang of the false board that serves as the incognito back door, which I left open, so it creaks now in the wind. Using my weed whacker as a cane, I brace and bend to inspect the top of the sea glass stall's workbench. Under the pin light, I see Johanna laid 2 sea-weathered, cobalt-blue bottle bottoms, both of which are so pitted and smooth they likely spent a century rubbing against the seafloor, against the coastline, gritted by sea salt. Truly rare pieces. She has out her copper wire, sterling silver, a foundry crucible for melting the silver, crucible tongs, a blowtorch, and wire cutters. Set to the side is another bottle of Bordeaux, which pins in place hand-drawn sketches of the design she intends to paint on each bottle-bottom necklace. 1 sketch is of a heart with the cursive word sisters. The other sketch is an infinity sign with the cursive words love forever. Beside the infinity love forever drawing, Johanna left a note card that says, "For my beautiful mop, I love you forever." I know, mop. She will never take this necklace off once it's finished. How deep she loves her mother, a fathomless well of love. Would my own child look at me like Mop does, Johanna? Doesn't Mop look at me too like that? Don't I deserve it, don't I? She's more like me, more like me. Stop, stop it. Love is not exclusive. Stop. Stop thinking and look around in the barn for the noise you heard. Security, make sure everyone is safe. This 3rd bottle of Bordeaux is half full. Johanna must have stumbled away from it and forgotten. Oh, Jojo, so that's what you were doing all day? I picture her in the day's summer sun, her white sundress, her big floppy hat. Barefoot with flamingo pink toes, like the wild sea girl she still is inside. I imagine her snaking her way along Haddock Point's curvy, rocky edge, scavenging for perfect sea glass pieces to add to her collections and projects. She's been hunting blue sea glass our whole lives. I shut off the workbench lamp and take a short swig of the Bordeaux. At this point, it's better I calm my nerves, despite my state. There are more shadows now in the center of the barn. My side room's amber overhead still pulses, and on each undulation, shadows move. Another creak of the false door in the back bangs, but this time I'm sure I hear a scamper of feet outside. I run into the lit side room to look out the window there, and when I do, I catch a glimpse of a shadow, nothing more, moving in the driveway, low to the ground. Once past my black Audi, beside which the black wisp of a shadow further ambiguates, whatever is running disappears. I can't make out what it is, but it appears blockish, bent, possibly on all fours, maybe, so I presume a deer, a neighborhood dog, something large. I'll call animal control in the morning to check the prints. I stand in the side room, the amber light pressing in on me like a warping trap. I crash the weed walker to the floor when I realize the ominous change in here. I slap myself, strain for my senses to come alive and make sense of things. Am I really seeing what I'm seeing? I witnessed a murder today. I witnessed a murder today. I witnessed a murder today. Am I in shock? I know the signs of shock. I am a nurse, and I believe I can diagnose. I am in shock. All the signs are here. I haven't talked about it yet. Mold clouds cover my tongue, scratchy, fibrous, and tasting of gray. I've gone about my evening in a haze. Haven't changed from my nursing uniform. Haven't called authorities. I'm walking in a barn chasing sounds and shadows. I need help. I need help. What do I do? Am I really seeing what I'm seeing in this room? I try to swallow the strangeness in my life. From this room, he, Kent Dranel, took something she, Kate Dranel, bungled upon when she rooted through his Jeep, and thereafter extorted her own husband with the knowledge, and thus, by doing so, extorted me by proxy. She has no clue I'm the source of the vials of pentobarbital Kent took from this room, vowing to rid them for me through some obscure back channels, alleviating me of their possession. He wouldn't confess to her where he got them. He let her hold the vials over his head and extort him into staying with her. But he promised last week that he was done, that he'd take the consequences and protect me, protect us. We'd be together no matter what, he said. Thing is, Kent didn't get all the vials. Instead of clay pots and heat lamps and seeds and bags of fertilizer that I intended take the space of this side room, there's a medical bed, a heart monitor, an EEG machine, a couple of drip lines and holders, a generator, a heating and cooling unit, a sterilizer, syringes, blood pressure cuff, and, under a floorboard under the bed, there should be more vials of the pentobarbital that Kent Dranel, my lover, the surgeon, thinks he rid me of. But he only got the vials I kept up top. All this equipment and medical devices and paraphernalia, lots of gauze, too, all innocently gained. A little while ago, I worked a private nursing job in Manchester by the Sea on an estate called Willow, and when my private patient survived and revived, the estate gave me the contents of their homemade hospital room, suggesting I offer private services to others of their kind. Wealthy New Englanders who scoff the brutal lighting and freezing cold of hospital wings. I don't know why I didn't decline. To make matters worse, in a flagrant apathy of drug laws, the people of Willow acted above the law. They gifted a case of pentobarbital, too. I should have turned it in. I didn't. I just didn't think it would ever lead to anything malicious. Pentobarbital is a Schedule II controlled substance used to induce comas. At the right dose, some states use it on death row. We're not talking about an unfinished pack of Cipro you lend a friend for her sniffles. So now I'm looking around this strange medical room in my barn, a light on, by, I had presumed, J. Johanna, and I wonder, as my eyes focus, my brain haze clears or muddles more, I wonder why, yes, why the floorboard under the medical bed, under which the remaining pentobarbital should be stashed, is now leaning against the white metal cabinet. I hand a knee to the floor to inspect under the bed. The underguts of the barn's crawl space, empty. No vials. No nothing. That was no shadow. No animal. I race back to Johanna in the guest cottage. Chapter 5. Auntie Liv. 2 years ago. I just found the floorboard disturbed in the side room of my barn. All my stashed pentobarbital is gone. I'm racing back to Johanna's guest cottage. Someone took the vials, and they must mean harm. That someone has to be Kate Drainel, Kent's wife, who killed Vicky today and knew about at least part of the vials. I'm spiraling in these thoughts. Had to be Kate who snuck in here, which means she knows about me. I should never have whispered in her ear. I reach the cottage, and at first can't open the door. It's barred. No, it's not barred. You're pulling, but you should be pushing. Slow down. Calm down. I'm so outright flustered and freaked I'm not breathing. Stop. Breathe. Breathe. Turn the knob. Push. I turn the knob and push. I am a nurse. I am better at panic. I'm better at panic when I'm a nurse. I open the door and am afforded a quick relief. My sister is snoring like a fat man after a turkey and a ball game and a trough of bud. But now that I know she's safe, relief leaves. I must protect her from whoever came here. I don't know what to do. I can't let her be harmed like I let Daddy be harmed. Johanna's my love, my light. Oh, Johanna, I'm scared, darling. I can't care for Mop on my own. I need you here, too. I do. Popover scowl meows at me from the sand dollar couch, and I won't sleep at all tonight. I'm going to sit next to Popover on the couch. We'll both stand guard over Johanna all night, forever. Kate Drainel took my pentobarbital. She knows about me. What do? I haven't heard from Kent. Had to be her. She was in my barn. Where else has she been? In the house? What is she going to do? I need to call the cops. I check my flip phone. No calls from Kent. I press 9, hover my finger over 1, intending to hit twice, but can't. They'll frame me for Vicky's murder. Kate will say I leaned over the booth and dusted peanuts when they both went to the bathroom. The cops won't care that I have no clue about Vicky or her allergies. I'll be framed. No, that's irrational. Doesn't matter how irrational. There's no videos at Proserpina's. I heard the bartender telling the cops, and I've heard before on other nights. Doesn't matter. There's nothing to prove my innocence or framed guilt. Kate's word against mine. Don't call. Don't call just yet. Think. Calm down. You're irrational. Wait for Johanna. She'll settle some reason. Keep this with Johanna. Keep your cool. Keep your job. Keep Mop's trust. Keep it together. Stay straight. Stick to the facts. And also, if I call the cops, I'll have to admit to my good-gotten but ill-kept drugs. At best, I'll lose my nursing license and reputation for having the pentobarbital in the first place. Call the cops. You should call the cops. I can't call the cops. I'll go to work tomorrow. What if they jail me for the drugs? What has Kate done with the vials? Will I be framed for something else, too? What? Talk to Kent. You need to talk to Kent. Where the hell is Kent? Call him. No, don't you call him. I'll be a nurse tomorrow and settle on a better plan. I'm talking to myself in first and third person, which I've never done before. Yes, you have. 4 other times you can recall, in fact, and likely more. When you let your father die, when you couldn't carry your first child, when you couldn't carry your second, when you discovered Sister Mary's secret and couldn't contain your outburst, your jealousy. Stop. Stop. This is different. This is different. Am I mad?
I'm not mad. Scared and aimless is all. I don't know what to do. I just need to get through this night. Tomorrow will be clear, and I will figure this out. I sit, and I stare, and I pace, and I inspect every window in this night cottage upon every creak of every tree. The light is a warping loneliness, shadowed in sinister evil in spots irrelevant in daytime. I sound like Mop. It's just night, no evil. Stop freaking out. It's just night, no evil. The blotch of black light on the floor by the heater vent is a hand reaching for me from hell. Stop it. The shape in the corner behind the puffy chair is Kate Drainel, standing still and silent, a shape-shifting shadow. I push an umbrella into the shadow's stomach and prove what I know. The night is the devil. As in, there is no being that is the devil. No, the devil is indeed the night. Now I really sound like Mop, equating intangible things with intangible things, dramatizing shadows into sinister beings, and anthropomorphizing objects and moving air. All of which would be fine if I could conjure and then deny such thoughts, like her. Get a grip. Be rational. Think like a nurse. Get through the night. I need some sleep. My eyes droop, but then another sinister footstep outside, which I must inspect. I find nothing but the big maple in the corner of the cottage's postage stamp yard. Big Boy, as we call the maple when we tap him for syrup, aches in the wind, which pushes the wood plank swing into the brambles behind and forward toward the cottage door. I watch the swing swing for a ghost, spotlit by moonlight. I wish I was dealing with just a ghost. A ghost would be easier than this, whatever this is. Maybe I'll sleep from morning until noon, after Johanna wakes. I return to the sand dollar couch. I curl my legs into my chest and cram my back into the sidearm, giving me perfect view of all four windows, the bathroom to my right, in which I dialed the overhead to the highest blazing sun setting, and the door in my sight line down the wall on my left, against which I rest my head. Only the coral dresser with the cherry on cake drawer, which holds Johanna's Marlboros, obstructs my view of the door handle, but not the door. Not the door. I can see the door. The door is locked. The drip from the sink faucet is a clock pounding out the slow seconds of my mad vigil. I should shut the knob tight, but tink, tink, tink drops of water pace my night. The faucet is a deranged conductor for a deranged situation. Stop allowing this foolish drama. Stop the dark metaphors. Stop thinking. Count up to 1,000,000 if you have to. Just stop. Popover pops to standing on my thighs, digging his paws into the fabric of my nursing skirt, and plops to the floor in a sudden slap of movement. He scampers across the floor and leaps upon the bed to curl into the sweat-wrinkled back of my sister's nightgown. She kicked her covers to the floor at some point in this warm June night, and her gown is hiked to mid-spine. Her moony cotton underwear, the type she sleeps in only when not with her husband, and thus what I call her real underwear, is on full-ass display. She snores. Flush. I love her. Her husband loves her mad, too, and she loves him mad back. Philip. She sleeps here at this cottage I built her, about once a week, because she always has. He travels for his family's business anyway, but not in the big fancy-pants aloof-has-100 global girlfriends kind of way. He flies commercial. First class, but commercial. No gold jet. No pit bull hired to entertain a cadre of escorts on a rented yacht in the south of France. Although Philip could afford such excursions. Philip is a hard worker for the family trust and charities, and always goes to and comes back as soon as his meetings are over. Johanna has traveled with him several times, and says he's all business and boring on these trips, so she typically stays with me. He brings her the sweetest things every time. Nothing expensive, just thoughtful items.
Sometimes he takes a picture of a beautiful flower and goes to the trouble of printing it, which no one does anymore, so she has something tangible to pretend to smell from abroad. Sometimes he walks whatever beach his hotel is on and finds Johanna a piece